Kildare Focus with Kira Noble.
Good afternoon. You're welcome to Thursday, and it is Kildare Focus. Kira Noble with you here until 3 o'clock this afternoon. Coming up, we'll be speaking with the chief executive of Women's Aid. More than half of young people, 53%, do not know that sharing intimate images without consent is now a crime. That is one of the findings in Women's Aid 2 Into You public awareness campaign. It's also including a new resource on how to help a friend when they are in an abusive relationship. Victor O'Loughlin, the vice president of the Border Midlands West region of the Union of Students of Ireland, discussed the protests outside Leinster House this week. That's part of three protests across the country calling for the cost of third level education to be decreased. John Murphy is the SIPTU sector organiser, and they are calling for reduced capacity on public transport to protect workers and passengers. Mark Byrne, the chief executive of Chime, on the deaf and hard of hearing children. They have three times the rate of socio-emotional difficulty. And we'll be going over to Newbridge, where Pat Costello is. He is around in KFM's OB unit, and do pop into him if you have any requests this afternoon. And the chief executive of Women's Aid joins me now. Good afternoon, Sarah Benson.
Hi, good afternoon.
Thank you very much for joining us. One of the I think, most worrying facts or stats that have been launched today is that one in five young women will be abused by the age of 18 compared to one in 11 young men. Obviously, both genders being abused, but it is very frightening when you see 20% of young women being abused by the age of 18.
Yeah, and I suppose just to clarify, it's actually the study was 18 to 25s. And I know that even 18 to 25, one in five young women is a really shocking statistic. And we do know that of that cohort, 51% of those young women experienced abuse for the first time under the age of 18. So we do know that this is not only a really worrying and prevalent issue, but one that also is impacting on not just adults, young adults, but also minors as well. And this was this is a follow-up study on a national survey we did last year. And so it was working to build on what was initially a prevalence study to look at what the experience was of young people. And we found then with our repeat study that the prevalence levels are still the same, equally high for women, actually slightly lower for men, but still showing a real problem for young people in terms of their vulnerability to abuse. And we also then wanted to go further with this study to look at what's sometimes referred to as the bystander approach. So we wanted to look at young people in terms of as a peer group who could potentially be a support to their loved ones, to a family member, to a friend, to a colleague, if they thought that they were in an abusive relationship. And so what we're launching today is our 2 Into You campaign, which is updated now with new resources, including, you know, a resource on how to help a friend, because one of the things that we found was that a very positive 81% of young people reported that they felt a responsibility to intervene in some way, to be of some support if they knew somebody who was being abused. But 84% felt that they were not at all confident in how to spot the signs of abuse and what to do. So they didn't have that level of confidence or awareness, which obviously can have a real chilling effect on that really positive motivation to be there, to be of help.
Now, Sarah, the study, just to note, it was the majority of young people, they feel a responsibility to intervene if they're concerned a close friend might be experiencing intimate relationship abuse, about 81%. But in a situation where, would say, you're in a public place, we've heard a lot to do with domestic abuse in general and what bystanders who don't know the person that's being abused should do. We know over in the States over the past few months, a huge story with the Gabby Petito case. She was caught on video camera by police over in the States, basically having some sort of fight argument while they were driving their car. And we know just a couple of months later, Gabby Petito's body was found in Woodlands in the States, and her boyfriend died by suicide. That just came out yesterday, about a month after that. So as would say a member of the public, and you're walking by or you notice in a restaurant or on the street and 2 minutes later that couple is gone, what can one possibly do to help in that situation?
I think it's important to realise that there's kind of different ways of looking at what we mean by bystander approach, and sometimes a distinguishing term would be bystander intervention, which might be like in that scenario where maybe you see strangers behaving in a certain way. And they do have a connection in the sense that the responsibility for preventing and combating all forms of violence and abuse, holding perpetrators to account, being a support, an ally, and assistance to victims, that is a responsibility for all in society, not just special services, not just the police. When we talk about an intervention in a scenario like that, it's a little bit more complex because it's more specifically looking at a single event at a particular moment in time, whereas what we were looking to explore when you're talking about domestic violence, when you're talking about intimate relationship abuse, that's about a pattern of behaviour, a pattern of often insidious, often manipulative behaviours that have the consequence of, coercively controlling, isolating, wearing down, another person in a relationship. So I think when we're talking about that and we're talking about the power of a bystander approach, it's really about, if you are close to somebody, you are well placed to spot the signs if you're given some support and information as to what those signs might look mm-hmm. like. But when you're talking about kind of public interventions, if it is in the context of an intimate relationship and in the absence of a very acute scenario of, an act of physical violence in a public place. And I think it's important to acknowledge that, the scenario you're talking about actually does look to, the social responsibility to intervene where you have public sexual assaults in public places and people being visibly, audibly abused, that there are scenarios where we would always say people need to act in a way that is safe for themselves. Mm-hmm. And usually contacting the authorities in that situation is the thing to do. There was an absolutely appalling case in New York where a woman was raped in public on a train, and it was only when a member of the authorities who was standing on the track looked in the window and saw what was happening, despite the fact that everybody else in the carriage not doing anything. So that scenario, you're Amazing. Saying there is a responsibility, absolutely to act. But where it's a relationship, those signs may be harder to spot, but people close can with support. And that's why we encourage people to look at 2NTU, look at the Women's Aid website, those kind of FAQs, what does it look like, what are the warning signs, and then to have the confidence that even if you're not 100% sure, if somebody is behaving in a way that might suggest that, they're feeling more vulnerable, that they're hypertense, that you're not seeing them as much, it could be an abusive relationship, and to reach out. And what's the worst thing that could happen? It might not be an abusive relationship, but maybe they are suffering in other ways with their mental health or for other reasons. And so it's still a good reason to reach out and just say, are you okay?
Yeah, and the research did note that very few young people believed it's easy to spot the signs of abuse in a friend's relationship, only 16%. Now, I know you're noting things like the FAQs on the 2NTU campaign and on Women's Aid and obviously other organisations like Men's Aid websites can give you some advice. But in one way, I guess it's good that people can recognise that it is very difficult to spot the signs, and that will help obviously maybe keep people's eyes peeled more than they would have previously if they believed they were easy to spot those signs.
Yeah, it's. I mean, some things can be easy to spot, obviously, if there's physical abuse and things like that. But actually, we know that the majority of abusive relationships are actually fundamentally grounded in, psychological, coercive, emotional abuse and a lot of very heavy controlling behaviour. And when you're given a little bit of signposting to say, well, what you think might be, in some cases, in early relationships, particularly with young people, what can be kind of seen as infatuation, and there's a term like love bombing, where they're they want to be in touch all the time, they want to be with you all the time, they want to know where you are, they want to know your every waking thought. That can seem, and that's sometimes been perceived as romantic, and isn't it amazing, and he's so into you. And then you can, but that can tip into actually, if that starts to have real life consequences for the person who's being, you know, treated to that kind of behavior, is like, if suddenly they feel, well, I can't go out with my friends because, you know, he'll get a little bit upset and he just wants us to be together all the time, or he gets real jealous, you know, when I talk to my male friends. If that means that somebody then stops talking to their male friends, that's where you're getting into red flags. That's where you have those warning signs. So yes, it is complex, and yes, it, you know, can be challenging to spot. But when you get that information and start looking through that lens, it does help you see kind of, okay, you're not talking about acute signs, but warning signs. And we do have a quiz actually on the Two Into You website, which is around kind of gauging the health of a relationship, you know, and it, you know, is it healthy? Are there a couple of red flags, or are there actually some serious red flags which would say this is probably, you know, getting into quite dangerous territory?
Sarah, obviously there's some great information on the Two Into You website in terms of what the research today we're speaking about, but would say people out there are listening and they themselves maybe are having second thoughts. Is my relationship possibly emotionally abusive? Is there coercive control, etc.? And they're having second thoughts at the moment. What does the potential abused do in a situation like that?
Absolutely. A really important question is that it's to know that there is support out there. We have, and also to really emphasise that contacting a support service like Women's Aid, we have the 24-hour national free phone helpline. We have an online instant messaging support service, which is run by our helpline team, our trained helpline team. Is that we have people reaching out when they're just at that point, exact point you're talking about. It's like something doesn't quite feel right, and so many times you'll have somebody at the other end of the phone and they'll say, look, I don't even know really why I'm calling. I'm not really sure this is for me. I'm sure there's people in much worse situations. And then they go on and they're given that space just to say what's going on. And often it's that their gut is telling them something, but somebody's messing so much with their head that, you know, it's becoming harder and harder to listen to their instincts. Giving that space can really help somebody, even at the earliest stages in a relationship, kind of work through, okay, if I bring this up with this person and then they react angrily or defensively, maybe that's a further reaffirmation that this isn't going in a good place, or it's an opportunity for the relationship to course correct, where maybe somebody says, jeepers, I'm so sorry, I didn't mean to be so kind of smothering of you. And, you know, and so it's early intervention is really, really important. So we would urge anyone who's in need of support not to wait until they feel they're kind of at breaking point, at absolute crisis point. You know, we're here from the very earliest points. And then our colleagues in the Men's Development Network run the free phone male advice line, although we'll also respond to anybody of any sex or gender. And if they need a follow-on support, we can signpost them all over the country for that.
Well, that's great to know that Women's Aid do for both genders, and advice if you are a male. But Sarah, you're obviously the chief executive of Women's Aid, and I'm just going to give out the number you're speaking about, the 24-hour helpline. That's 1800 341 900, and as Sarah said, the Men's Development Agency within that can address any male issues that people may have. But also, just while we're on the topic, I will give out the Men's Aid Ireland number, and that's 01554 3811. And if you want some more information about what Sarah's talking about this afternoon, the Two Into You website will give you all the stats and the data, and of course the quiz, as you were mentioning there, Sarah, which could aid a lot of people. Sarah Benson, the Chief Executive of Women's Aid, thanks so much. And just to let you know, I'm going to give you the numbers again for Women's Aid and Men's Aid. So Women's Aid first, this is the 24-hour helpline, 1800 341 900, and Men's Aid is 01554 3811. And if you did miss those, now moving on to third level students, they have been protesting this week. Joining me to discuss this is Victor O'Loughlin. He's the Vice President for the Border Midlands West region of the Union of Students of Ireland. Good afternoon, Victor.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Victor, tell us exactly why the students were protesting this week.
So this week we've actually had our national campaign, which was split up into three different regions, split up into three different counties. And it was part of our Cost of College campaign. And this campaign has been targeted at the unfortunate situation students are being presented with year after year, where we have the highest fees in the European Union. And the cost of actually getting to college is going up and up every single year. The rents are just going up at a scandalous rate, where the government seems to be ignoring it time and time again. It doesn't seem to be something the government does want to talk about. We had our Sleep Out Outside the Dáil under the No Keys, No Degrees campaign, which I would have spoken to you previously about. And the Tánaiste himself actually had to be asked within the Dáil on that very day, will he go out and speak with the students? And he refused to do so when called upon his colleagues. It's starting to feel like students' queries, students' issues are falling on deaf ears within the government. So we took to the streets in Cork, we took to the streets in Dublin, and we took to the streets in Galway to voice our concerns so that people can hear what is going on that's being kept under the carpet by the government.
You know, one of the arguments I've heard when it comes to the third level students protesting about different things is there's bigger problems, etc. You know, they're giving out about the cost of food, you know, all the basics. But college is not just, obviously, it's a time that, you know, you do need to be buying the basics for yourself when you're living alone and when you're going out grocery shopping. When it comes to rent, obviously astronomical prices across the board, no matter if you are a third level student or not. But when you are in that stage of your life, you are hoping to do the extras, like going out, socialising. And if people cannot afford to scrimp and save to get the bare minimum, like food and somewhere to live, they're hardly going to be able to enjoy that time of their lives in terms of the social aspects and the extras that do come along with being a third level student.
Yeah. And, you know, you actually raised two very great points I want to touch on. The first of them is the cost around food, the cost of electricity. As our campaigns officer, Beth O'Reilly, said, that they all fall under the cost of college. The cost of college isn't just €3,000, the annual fee. It's also your rent. It's your transport to and from college. It's your ESB bill. It's the heating. It's the clothes. It's the copies. It's the textbooks. It's the workbooks that you might have to buy every 2 or 3 weeks. And it's your food. Those all up to thousands of euros a month. And rent alone is thousands of euros a year. Or sorry, not thousands of euros, sorry, thousands of euros a year. But then there's the social aspect as well. Students do like to have fun. That's where at that time in your life where you do want to go out, you do want to socialise. Quite a lot of students are being cautious. A lot of students are living from home. There are students that do like to go out. But I think you'll find that the nightlife sector is sort of struggling at the moment as well. I know I worked in a local students' union where we found it hard to get sponsorship because students weren't going out as much as they were. Now, you can make the argument that we're coming towards the end of a pandemic, or maybe we're not, but students have been at home for the last year and a half and they want to go out now to celebrate. But the cost of going to college is astronomical. It's just going up year after year. You know.
And Victor, when it comes to the part-time jobs, obviously that was another big hit in terms of the pandemic and third level students, because there weren't those jobs that you could take up in the bars or the retail stores because they're all shut.
Yeah, the pandemic hit students very hard. And what we found even just before the pandemic, and I suppose the last viable study was through the Irish Times, and it was in 2019, just before the pandemic hit, around this time of the year, around November. And I said about a third of students were actually skipping college just to pay for going to college. And since then, the rent has gone up, the cost of food has gone up, the cost of fuel and electricity has gone up. So we haven't had a study since, but I can only imagine that there would be more students that there would be more of a percentage of students would be willing to skip college. And then that kind of opens up the conversation then of, should we be making education more accessible to those students? And that opens up the question of a blended approach or the option of online learning, so students could learn at a time that suits them instead of the conventional 9 to 5 hours.
Yeah, no, it definitely contradicts the fact why people are going to third level in the first place if they're having to skip it
100%.
And take on their part-time job. Listen, Victor O'Loughlin, the Vice President for the Border Midlands West Region of the Union of Students of Ireland, thanks so much for the time. And obviously that was about the students protesting outside Leinster House this week. And if you want some more information, do head to the USI's website, usi.ie.
Kildare Focus with Ciarán Noble.
Now, moving on to John Murphy. He is SIPTU Sector Organiser. Good afternoon, John.
Good afternoon, Ciara.
You are calling alongside the union, obviously, for reduced capacity on public transport to protect workers and passengers.
Yeah, we have. Look, throughout the various different stages of the COVID pandemic last year and this year, there has been times where the capacity on public service vehicles has been reduced to 50% and 75%, depending on the COVID numbers at the time. Now, with the recent upsurge in COVID numbers and infection rates, We believe that, the decision needs to be made to reduce the capacity in all modes of public transport for a protection for the staff working in these environments and also for the passengers using it. It makes sense, you know, to reduce it at this time, and we've called on the government to do such.
Yeah, John, currently with regulations as things are, you do have to wear a face covering when you get onto public transport. And we know that does help, you know, I guess, ease the transmission of COVID-19, which is incredibly high, probably at the highest level it's ever been since the pandemic was declared. So this obviously doesn't seem to be enough for SIP2.
No, and it doesn't. And look, we've seen at the outset where there was very little, you know, the passenger levels dropped significantly at the outset of COVID. They were down 90% down on the normal travelling numbers. But that has increased over the last few months. There was a return to 100% capacity on vehicles in the end of August this year, because that suited the time and the infection rates. But with the upsurge, it's ridiculous that, you know, passengers and workers are faced with situations where on buses, trains and trams, you know, every seat is full and even standing room. You know, I know there's been a call for people to work remotely, but it hasn't transpired into numbers as yet in public transport. There still is vehicles overloaded and above capacity. And the sensible thing to try and restrict the infection rate needs to be taken immediately, just, you know, to give people the opportunity to continue to provide the transport service they do and that's needed, but also in the safest manner.
John, did you look into any stats in terms of, would say, public transport and reducing the capacity? Right at the moment, we know that, you know, the infection rates are very high. We can't be, you know, specific about the percentage of transmission or the rate because we have had such high demand for testing, it's difficult to actually get the specifics. But if it was to go back, would say, to 75% capacity, would that bring down the rate of transmission of the disease within our communities by much? Because we do know that a huge majority of those who are being diagnosed with COVID-19 are those in the primary school age category. Now, today, the European Medicines Agency did give the authorisation for the Pfizer-BioNTech in a smaller dose to be given to those between 5 and 11. Now, NIAC, the National Immunisation Committee here in Ireland, will decide on its use in this country, and that's not been released, obviously, yet. So, obviously, these children have to have parents and guardians who are probably part of those who are using the public transport every day. But in the whole scheme of things, would it reduce the transmission rate by much?
Well, look, I'm far from an expert on immunology and infection rates and what are the main causes, but it's only obvious. If you look at what has transpired over the last 18 months, where the government and the medical people made decisions in the interest of public safety to reduce the capacity, you know, surely that then leads itself to a similar decision being made now when cases and surges are on the rise. Fine, you know, schools could be one of the breeding ground, but a lot of, you know, school children use public transport to access their schools, to and from school. So, you know, are we moving the problem from one place to another? It just makes sense, and it makes sense in line with what has happened over the last 18 months that the capacity should be reduced. We were of a belief that government were going to make an announcement to reduce the services in public transport. Now, that only means that there's more passengers with less vehicles being utilised. So, again, that could lead to overcrowding. So the only sensible situation is if you reduce the capacity, reintroduce, you know, where they had the cordoned off sections on buses, so the social distancing is permitted and is applied. It's going to, will it impact significantly? Who knows? But it will impact the numbers, and it will give some sort of solace to the passengers and to the workers that they are being looked at and they are being protected as much as possible. We all know public transport needs to continue, so it needs to continue in the safest way possible.
Okay, interesting. So SIP2 organises more than 4,500 workers employed on all forms of public transport.
Buses, trains and trams, yes.
Yeah, and as John notes, a lot of the time it's the workers themselves and the drivers of the buses or the, you know, ticket takers on the train.
On the trains and the trams,
exactly, that are put to the back of people's mind. Listen, thank you so much, SIP2 sector organiser John Murphy, for joining us there.
Kildare Focus with Ciarán Noble.
But joining me now is the Chief Executive of Chime, and he's speaking to us about the deaf and hard of hearing children that have three times the rate of socio-emotional difficulty. Mark Byrne, good afternoon.
Hi, Kira. Good afternoon.
Mark, my first question to you is obviously this particular research is done by yourselves at Chime and it was released yesterday. So the children who are deaf and hard of hearing have three times more of a rate of being having socio-emotional difficulties. Just to begin, what exactly is a socio-emotional difficulty?
Yeah, so first of all, Kira, thanks for having us on. I think it was really important for us in Chime to commission this research, and we were able to partner with DCU to do so. And I suppose to our social work and family support teams over the years, we've often seen the challenges and problems that deaf and hard of hearing kids would face. And I suppose we wanted to be able to kind of quantify and verify that. So that's why we undertook the kind of specific research that we did. But I suppose to answer your question, it's really about the day-to-day living. Where do they cope well? Where do they cope not so well? It's things like peer relationships come across in the report as one of the most challenging areas. But it's also kind of the day-to-day living, the interaction with other people, the coping skills when things don't go well. So it's there's a kind of an international standard called the Strengths and Difficulties Questionnaire, the SDQ, which is a standard kind of format for assessing their social and emotional strengths and weaknesses, I suppose.
Yeah, 42% have clinically significant socio-emotional problems. And of those, only 14% are currently receiving mental health or counselling supports. Why is the percentage of those receiving help so low, do you feel?
Yeah, it's an incredibly stark statistic, Kira. I think, I suppose the primary reason is the lack of specialist support. So for deaf services, for deaf and hard of hearing children in particular, it's quite a small number of people throughout the general population, and it's quite a specific area of expertise. So at the moment in Ireland, we simply don't have a specialist team. So we've seen over the years, for example, parents travelling to the UK, we used to be able to bring specialists from the UK over. So things like a child psychological assessment to identify kind of where, you know, needs might be acute or additional kind of supports might be required. We don't have one of those in Ireland. So your very starting point of getting a good assessment is not something we in the state provide for these children. Equally then, there's I think maybe one part-time speech and language therapist, again, throughout the country. So it begs the question that, you know, if we can't get a speech and language therapist for a deaf or hard of hearing child outside of the mainstream services, those kids are going to be at a disadvantage. And it's important to say here, it's not the deafness in itself that it causes the difficulties. It's kind of the delayed diagnosis of underlying problems or additional problems, or it's delayed access or non-access to services that then lead to kind of the challenging behaviour, difficulty with coping skills and on into peer relationships and peer problems. So it's primarily the lack of services and the delayed diagnosis of additional needs that are causing these problems.
And Mark, you noted yourself that in 2017, the HSE did acknowledge that there is a need for specialist screening and intervention services for deaf and hard of hearing children with complex needs. So 2017, that was at least 2.5 years before the pandemic was declared. So why is it that more services have not been put in place? Did you get any answers from the HSE?
Yeah, it's a great question, Kira. Look, we've had a lot of positive discussions with the HSE, particularly over the last 12 months. The HSE primary focus around children's services at the moment is a thing called PDS, Progressing Disability Services, where it tries to find a strong pathway for children with complex needs across a range of services. And I suppose we're such a small cohort of the population, and it's a fight for anything kind of that's a little bit outside the norm to get done. Like I say, we're having lots of positive conversations with the HSE, but we really need action, and we really need to see kind of a small budget in the big scheme of things delivered, Kira, for a what we would call a multidisciplinary team, which would allow for those assessment needs to be carried out, the speech and language therapist or the occupational therapist, which are supports for these deaf children.
Mark, if people want to get in touch with Chime, how do they go about doing so?
Yeah, very very easy, Kira. It's chime.ie is our website, which is the best way to get us, and all relevant information. We've 12 offices around the country to support people in. All the details will be on chime.ie.
Great, thank you very much. That is Chime's Chief Executive Mark Byrne there discussing the socio-emotional difficulties that deaf and hard of hearing children have at 3 times the rate of those who are not deaf or hard of hearing. Now, are you lucky enough, well, some would say lucky, I myself, I'm not too pushed, to have grabbed yourself a Garth Brooks ticket this afternoon. He's doing 5 dates at Croke Park. Now, it's official, obviously, earlier on we heard that the 5 concerts will be held. A 3rd date was added earlier this morning for Sunday the 11th of September, and then that was quickly followed by the Friday, which is the 16th of September, and the Saturday the 17th. Now, according to Ticketmaster's website, obviously there was very low availability straight away and it's now sold out. Supposedly, the Irish Examiner is reporting that the residents of Croke Park are saying that the 5 gigs going ahead are unacceptable. It was 2014 that he was supposed to come and obviously they were cancelled at the time. What do you think? Should he be able to get the 5 nights? Because someone like me, who's not a massive fan of Garth Brooks, wants somebody like Beyonce to do 5 nights. Obviously, she mightn't sell out the 5 nights. But why exactly does Garth get the... get the room to do so. So as I was saying, they did obviously all sell out, and Aislinn O'Donoghue was one of those fans that queued outside for 3 days to get tickets last time around.
I joined the queue at 7:30 this morning, and by the time the queue opened up at 8 o'clock, there was 120,000 people in front of me. I had a laptop open, I had phones, and the queues just weren't budging. So it was about 10 to 9 by the time I actually managed to secure 2 tickets for Friday night.
Are you going? Am I missing out by not going? I just don't have... It's not on my bucket list to go see Garth. I am joined by Pat Costello. He is in Newbridge, the best place. How is it going over there, Pat?
Very good indeed, Kira. Garth Brooks is now doing the Drive for 5. It's not the Dubs anymore. It's Garth Brooks doing the Drive for 5.
I know. What do you think? Would you go?
No, I won't go.
Why?
I think I just played my autobiography there. Yeah, Friends in Low Places. it's just a bit of madness, really, you know. I would prefer to see a football game in Croke Park or a hurling game, you know. But anyway, that's me. I'm not going to be a Christmas Grinch. I'm out and about all over Newbridge all afternoon. As I was saying earlier, we were in the Curragh camp, and you being the authority, Kira, on all things royal, did you know that in 1861, Queen Victoria herself and Prince Albert visited the Curragh camp to inspect the troops because their son, Edward the VII, I think it is, yeah, the Prince of Wales, he was there, stationed there, and there are photographs from that event in the Royal, I can't remember what it's called, but it's in Windsor Castle anyway. So the next time you're over in Windsor Castle, pop in there and see if you can see photographs from 1861 and the Queen Victoria visiting the Curragh camp. Don't forget I told you where it was.
Okay.
Anyway, I've been out and about. I've headed over to Athgarvan as well. That's starting to build up a little bit. But the amount of, I suppose, housing developments between Newbridge and Athgarvan is immense. Soon they will all be one. So then will they call it New Garvan or Athbridge? I'm not so sure. But lots of developments there. Lots of retail space in and around there as well. We're now at the moment, we're in Newbridge Shopping Centre, which is absolutely packed from a car park point of view. I haven't been inside. But where I was inside was Newbridge Silverware, because as you know, Kira, they have the Museum of Style icons in there, and I heard a little story that one and only late and great Brendan Grace, an exhibition on his clothes opened today. So I popped in, and sure enough, all the clothes that Brendan Grace would have worn on a stage when he was Father Fintan in Father Ted, when he was out in the in the Lebanon entertaining the troops, and of course Butler and all of that. So that's a nice, the free exhibition, so that's on. I'm heading now over towards, I suppose, the Sarsfield side of
right side of Newbridge.
Down around Main Street and Rosebery and all of that. But we're having good fun. You can see the build-up to Christmas starting already. I mentioned to John that Christmas trees are being sold along the side of the roads as well now. So there you go. Forget about Garth Brooks. Christmas is on the way, and it's a Lily White Christmas that we're promoting.
Thank you so much for listening to Caoimhe Harney and to Owen Beattie. We'll speak to you tomorrow.
Kildare Focus with Kira Noble.